Oh, another great edition of Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, coming to you from Northwestern Surprise, Arizona, on our way up to Camp Verde. We're going to be doing some radio shows up there, and then we're on the Prescott tomorrow for sign production, and then we're heading north near Canada. We're going to Washington State, do some activism there. Then we're traveling across the country again, and then we'll come back to Arizona for the holidays. Now, up not too far from where we're going to be is Ray McGinnis. Now, Ray McGinnis is the author of the newly released book on 9/11, appropriately timed, and it's called Unanswered Questions, What the September 11th Families Asked and the 9/11 Commission Ignored. Now, this, I have a lot of questions, and the main one when we first, we'll start off right here. I just want to make sure, you know, Ray, you know, get ready, here it comes. I started doing radio in February of 03. This was just weeks, a month before the land invasion in Iraq because of 9/11. Now, I had one question. Where did all the molten metal come from? They would take excavators, and as they were going into World Trade Center and pulling up the steel, molten steel would drip. It was like that for weeks. It is just that enormous amounts of energy had to go in to melt that steel. And I'm going, yeah, that wasn't, you know, jet fuel. So then you had columns, support columns that were severed at angles. All this was totally ignored by the lamestream media, the media so last century. So now Ray McGinnis, being Canadian, certainly still had the effects of a post 9/11 world. And I'm wondering, you know, what is your genesis for working on this book and the family's questions, and what were they? But first, give some props to my question. I've been asking this for years. Finally, we had, you know, some answers years later. But Ray, help us out. Welcome to the show. Thank you.
Okay. Great.
Help us out with that question, would you please?
Okay, sure. Great to be with you. And it's the question you're asking. I always distinguish the Family Steering Committee for the 9/11 Independent Commission and their questions to the 9/11 Commission to investigate, and many other broader important questions that people in the 9/11 truth have asked. And the question you're asking is not a question that the family specifically asked about the molten metal, though there were reports, but they didn't ask that particular question. They asked a question of the 9/11 Commission more generally to comment on. They want the government to comment on reports of explosions, which can take us to the question of molten metal, because that's one of the things that say, well, there are some problems here. I mean, there were reports. Patty Casaza, whose husband John called her to say I love you from the North Tower on 104th floor, I think, said I love you, I've tried to get to the rooftop, can't get out, but hearing bombs in the building going off. He said he and other colleagues believe there are bombs going off in the building. So that sort of one of the dozen members of the Family Steering Committee, that was kind of their entry point to say, well, what about this 9/11 commission, tell us. So then there's these questions about molten metal, and it just seems that the explanations about, I mean, I've been to the 9/11 Museum and Memorial, and if you go, you might be lucky to get the same guide that I got, who walked around the parapets of the footprints of the towers, and he told me and the other people in the little group that the steel frame buildings were weakened by fire. Now, what I know is Kevin Cosgrove was in the South Tower. He was on the phone to emergency, to 911, talking, saying we need help and everything, from about 9:44 to 9:59 when the South Tower collapsed. He's talking on a landline phone. His receiver is cool enough for him to hold in his hands. And the cord from his phone to the jack on the wall is cool enough to not be impaired, as is the jack on the wall, so he can talk to the operator for 15 minutes. And yet, we're told that steel melted from jet fuel or something else, which needs to be 2800 degrees Fahrenheit. So how can you have a telephone receiver be cool enough for a person to hold, and yet steel melting all around you. Plus firefighters like Oreo Palmer reaching the 78th, 79th floor and telling the people coming up behind him in different battalions that that's safe for them to proceed. Human beings should be in more danger of fire.
Crispy critters, yeah.
Yeah. So something, so the footprint, yeah. Fire Engineering Magazine, Bill Manning was a blistering editorial in January of 2002. And he mentions in his editorial, I think, about the fires and maybe molten metal, I'm not sure, but certainly says that the whole investigation up until 2002 with FEMA and taking all the scrap off the site as fast as they could was a, quote, farce.
We remember when they were clearing the site, and activists that have been around for a while, we remember this as the same operating procedure from before. It was called Waco. They just bulldozed it, and how fast could they clean it up and evidence be gone? And this has been, and when we had investigations of where the explosions and how they were done, and they started checking dust, and they were looking at what scrap memorial pieces that they had left and dust that people had just accumulated, or saved that lived there, they found what?
Yeah, so Jeanette McKinley, who lived in World Trade, across from World Trade Center 4, who was an artist and did a lot of exhibits in the World Trade Center area, in her apartment, I think on the fourth floor across from World Trade Center 4, when they sort of had this blast of all this debris when the South Tower collapsed, she was making choices about what to take with her as they were leaving their place, and she happened to take a jar of the dust. She did a lot of things with art to express herself afterwards. She did things like having Osama bin Laden in the crosshairs, and she even thought about, she was so enraged about what had happened to her life and her partner and everything. He was alive but very sick now from the dust. She thought of joining the U.S. military and going off to war in Afghanistan. Didn't do that, but she saved this dust as it happens. And 6 or 7 years later, she gave it to some engineers, scientists, physicists. I think they were both from America and Europe that were looking at it. And they did some tests on it and showed that there were some metal elements that needed to have temperatures as hot as in the 4,000s Fahrenheit, to melt. So clearly there are problems. I remember her saying that, so often with the families, they're given, their starting place is to give the benefit of the doubt, and residents of the buildings, like they're wondering, but they're not accusing, or partisan in any way. So she went after the 9/11 Commission report came out to the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco, expecting that the several commissioners on tour would answer their questions. And she said that the answer to every single question for the Q&A after the presentation by the several 9/11 commissioners who were there was, "That's classified.
National security."
Yeah.
National security used to mean Americans' individual rights, or we were the boss, and we were. 9/11 was the wake-up call for so many people. By the time we got more involved nationally with the Ron Paul effort in 07, 08, there was a lot of the activists, a lot of the young people, a lot of the people, it was 9/11 that woke them up. I think, again, now it's like every 2-3 election cycles, presidential election cycles, you get this. It was, Goldwater, then Reagan, then Perot, then Ron Paul, then Trump. I mean, this kind of – it may not be them individually. It's that they represent a time period. There's, 2 or 3 presidential election cycles every 8, 12 years. There's like a the AI has to figure out something to get you back on the plantation or something. You know, the slaves are waking up. We got to do something, you know. And it's been like clockwork as I just turned 60. And as time goes on, I've been through this. Now, fortunately for my children, you know, and their friends and so on, haven't experienced, you know, this activism, you know, this kind of awareness that we've had, you know, even at a young age, you know, they're 9, 10, 11. I go, remember this? I mean, you know, this is, they do, you know, and this has had an impact on their lives. So I wanted to ask you, in that kind of perspective, the people that you're writing for, the questions from the families, you know, we've had so many young children that were, saw that their, one of their parents died in this building collapse, and they have questions, and they see their other parent asking these questions and what, you know, answers that they're getting. I'm wondering what the next generation, it's been 20 years, you know, little kids, they may be under 30. They're in their 20s now. You know, their friends and neighbors, there's a lot of people, you know, I'm thinking, you know, one person I happen to know well, Luke Radowski from We Are Changed in Brooklyn. I mean, this is how he started. I remember him as a 16, 17-year-old kid, you know, or even younger than that, you know, asking questions and pushes, and then he kept going on into other things. And now he's like, you know, we do gun church. You got to practice religiously every Sunday, you know, from New York, you know, out of state. And now he's just, he's preaching to his audience that we are under a continuous lying, deceitful. There's some other agenda. So the generation next of the parents, children that you're being a voice for, what's their perspective? Do you have a chance to talk to them or experience their awakening?
Just in a few cases, I think that one person I can mention, Lori Van Auken, whose husband Kenneth Van Auken died in the North Tower. She was left with two children, one of them, Sarah, and who was still a child. But in 2000, I'm trying to think when it would be. In the mid 2010s, she was going on to study at college, and she focused on arts and drama. And after she graduated, I believe she created a one woman show called "This Is Not About 9/11." Although her show is about it, but it's also about more than that. And what she does, I wasn't able to see it. It was on in just a few, you know, short runs in off Broadway in New York, and also did show in the Philadelphia area. And Bob McElvain, whose son Bobby, he's been a very active, you know, in seeking truth and justice, he was able to see it and thought it was terrific. What she does is she comes into like a, you know, it's like she's having an interview with somebody from the 9/11 Museum who's interviewing, you know, family victim member, you know, 2,463. It's like the 9/11 Commission is, the museum is interviewing these, you know, thousands and thousands of family members have one more story. And in this one woman performance with the interviewer from the museum, who's, you never see, who's just off the stage asking questions and discussing things with her, with Sarah Van Auken, the 9/11 museum interviewer's whole purpose is to try and get the family member, being Sarah Van Auken, to just talk about the very sad story about her dad dying, and about bring out the Kleenex box and feel badly about, you know, about his death, which she does very much. But what she does in the play is she tells the museum interviewer that she wants to not just talk about how sad it is that her dad died or what a wonderful person he is. She also wants to talk about her mother, Lori Van Auken's amazing advocacy and being one of the people who ended up being part of the family steering committee, and all of the questions that they brought to the 9/11 commission that were received by the commissioners speaking to the press, saying, Thank you, family members, for bringing these questions to us. These will be a roadmap for us to do our investigation. And Sarah Van Auken is talking about, to the museum interviewer in this one woman play, saying in response to the him keeps trying to steer her back to the teary Tammy Faye Baker kind of world he wants to stay in, and she says yes, but the families wanted to know, you know, why were there stock options on airplanes before the buildings fell, and why did Bin Laden families fly out, and why did the airplanes not get scrambled to intercept the hijacked planes, and all kinds of questions. And the interviewer from the museum in this play just doesn't want to hear it and ignores it and keeps bringing it back to the very contained, teary-eyed focus of sentiments and tragedy. And so that's just one person. And I think that there are a lot of people who've lost loved ones, who now had 15, 20 years to think about it. And I think others who I don't know about are probably also raising questions now. I haven't seen yet The Unspeakable by Dylan Avery, the brand new documentary that interviews Drew De Palma and a number of other family members. But I think from what I know, Drew De Palma, whose I think mother Jean died, for a long time, he didn't think much about, it's partly you're just sort of in shock and you're numb and you just want to get on with your life somehow. But I think that there are numbers of family members like him that more recently have started to get become activists and are asking questions now. Because I talked to one person whose nephew was one of the New York Police Department in the chopper, taking photos of Ground Zero before and after the towers collapsed. And this man told me that he'd asked his nephew, the police officer, if he thought much, about September 11th, just a couple years ago. And his son, his nephew, the police officer, said hardly at all. And so for some people, it's like they're either right back there on the day and they're traumatized all over again, or they just can't think about it. But then there's other people like Sarah Van Auken that will make a play.
I'm wondering what psychological aspect or trait there is in humans that they were trying to trigger with the emotional response to this. Tell us about your feelings. Tell us about, who do you want to go kill? Who you want to bomb? You want to join the, they needed some kind of, reaction that would be supported by the government agencies or the narrative that was supported. And Bush there with the firefighters and the flag, we can go get some, that kind of thing. And as opposed to me from the beginning, and we had gone through these kinds of, I don't know, events, false flags, flags, whatever the heck you want to call it. And it has been that they are never pursued as a criminal investigation. They don't have the evidence, and then they follow the evidence. They go with the evidence. They take it where it leads them. They get to a certain point, and boom, there's a roadblock. Oh, we don't discuss that. That doesn't support the narrative. The narrative will be this. We don't care about these questions. We don't want to answer that. And I remember it was 9/11 wives, or what was the
Jersey Girls.
The Jersey Girls. And they, we promoted them heavily at the time because they were the ones that were really doing what you're doing, forcing the questions. We got to look. We got to have, then when they did the 9/11 commission, even the people that did the 9/11 commission go, hey man, this is, yeah, we know it's crap and we don't want to play and have our names on this thing. So where and when does the truth come out? I mean, other generations had, JFK, which, Jacob Hornberger from the Future Freedom Foundation is not going to let that one go. I mean, he's definitely on JFK assassination constantly. 9/11 is this generation's JFK. But you see that the connection is the same. And then even with the COVID thing, you're just going, there's something else going on. There's an agenda being promoted. What do you think it is?
Well, I mean, Paul O'Neill, who was the Treasury Secretary, wrote his book, the memoir, The Price of Loyalty, in 2004. And he said that he was sitting at the first cabinet meeting for the new Bush White House in January of 2001, when the president basically said, you know, I want to finish what my dad started in Iraq. I want to go to war in Iraq and find a way to get me how to do that. And then Donald Rumsfeld spent a long time talking about the need for regime change in Iraq and weapons of mass destruction and all the things that were the talking points for the Iraq war. And Paul O'Neill just couldn't believe it. And Max Cleland, who was on the 9/11 commission until he resigned with disgust in November of 2003, really pushed the 9/11 commission and the commissioners themselves to investigate, you know, is there a connection between the war in Iraq and the effort to go to war in Iraq and what happened on September 11th? And the other nine commissioners, I gather, just were not interested in pursuing that. Interestingly, when Max Cleland resigned, the Family Steering Committee pushed for a couple of people who could be nominated to replace Max Cleland, and that was actually Tom Daschle, the Democrat minority leader at the Times, decision to appoint someone, and he chose, they said, well, appoint Kristen Breitwiser, one of the Family Steering Committee members themselves, and she'll make sure that we can steer this inquiry in the right direction. And they said, no, we're going to appoint Bob Kerry from Nebraska. Now, you know, Bob Kerry later on, he publicly said he thought that there should be a permanent 9/11 commission. Lots of questions still. But at the time, I didn't realize this until I stumbled upon it while I was still writing my book. He was part of the Committee for Regime Change in Iraq, if that's the correct name for it. If he was a moderate, everybody else was extremely right-wing and hawkish, and that committee was all about going to war in Iraq. So it's a very interesting choice to have him appointed at that point. But even then, he's appointed, and within days, he's threatening to resign because he found out that Philip Zelikow, the executive director, had all these conflicts of interest, that he'd co-authored books with Condoleezza Rice, that he had been authoring the paper for preemptive war and the whole effort to go to war in Iraq. And so Kerry said, you know, what's going on here? But he was persuaded to stay on. And in terms of having a narrative, the 9/11 Commission report itself, all the chapters and chapter subheadings were written up as an outline by the executive director, Phil Zelikow, and senior counsel Ernst May in March 2003, before the first public hearings. All these chapter headings and subheadings, and then at the end of the when the report was released and published in July of 2004, if you compare the outline that was there in 2003 in March with the published report, you've got almost word for word, you know, slight changes in maybe a chapter location, but it's almost identical. And Bob McIlvaine said it's just outrageous that the kind of outline for what the report would find was written before they began the investigation. Normally, you want to you assume that you're going to have some witnesses come forward and say something that's going to take the investigation in a new direction. But they decided, no, this is the story. This is the narrative.
You know, we had I remember here in Arizona, McCain said, you know, it's going to be a 20-year war on terrorism. Had a guest on, and he goes, you know, at least before they had the courtesy to name the Six-Day War and the 100-Year War and this war after the war, you know, before they already predetermined it's going to be 20 years. And then, of course, 20 years later, here we come out of, you know, Afghanistan. So it seems so scripted. And I'm wondering, scripted for what? You know, as you write your book and these questions, I'm wondering what you saw, who benefited the most, where, why, you know, who benefited from this? What did we get out of it? You know, we're gazillions of dollars in debt. You know, there's just, I can go on a long list of the detriment of 9/11 and what they've done. I'm wondering what you uncovered that you just go, aha, that's why. What do you think it was?
So, you know, writing about this the family steering committee was an interesting challenge because, and I'll get to your question, because you have 12 people. I don't know how many of them voted in 2000, but five of them that I know of that told the press how they voted, three of those five, including Patty Cassata, voted for the Bush-Cheney ticket. So you've got numbers of people who are, Republican voters, Bush supporters. Bill Harvey said he voted for George H.W. Bush twice in 88 and 92, and probably Bob Dole and George H.W. Bush in 2000. But by the as the whole thing is rolling along, by October of 2003, even Bill Harvey, who's registered Republican, voting Republican all the time, is outraged that at the stonewalling and sabotaging of the administration, and no, hardly any subpoenas and everything. And it seems that the, so like Mindy Kleinberg will say things like she was always hopeful that the government would answer their questions. So there's a real kind of a dance that the family steering committee is playing with being hopeful and respectful and courteous, even though they're hard hitting sometimes, like the Jersey Girls were. I think that at the very least, what seems to be going on is a kind of a strategy of tension. I know from years ago reading about Cold War in the 50s, and John Foster Dulles, was he the Secretary of State? I know Allen Dulles was with the CIA, but his brother John Foster Dulles in the Eisenhower administration. And back then, and this maybe is looking back can help us somehow see where we are now. Back in after Stalin died in 53, there's a little bit of a thaw between American-Soviet relations, and you have a new leader, eventually Nikita Khrushchev, and there is an overture for a peace summit in 1955, and Eisenhower was quite open to this, and but John Foster Dulles did everything he could to make sure that that would not go well, that the Cold War would still go on full steam ahead. And it seems that in I don't know, declassified or available now in the public, decades later, that his view was that there needs to be an enemy. America needs to have an enemy, the Soviet Union, something. Because in his view, and he's quite a, anti-communist, and I can go on about Stalin was legitimately a bad guy, but anti-communist, and the view was, if we can't be spending all this money on defense and the whole kind of emotional aura of the threat of bombs dropping and nuclear annihilation and all of this, if we just walk away from all that and make a peace deal with the Soviets and spend half as much on building missiles and weapons and everything and being on guard all the time, then that means you're going to have more money to spend on building highways, on education, arts, theater, parks, the peace dividend. And he didn't want that, because then there'd be, liberalism forever, or whatever he thought, socialism, whatever he thought that was. You don't want to have people going out on sidewalks and painting things and making it beautiful. So it was, it's kind of a, there's a view that you've got to keep people tense and nervous and anxious about something bad that's going to happen, a
To what
war.
end? I mean, to maintain control. I mean, it seems that this is always about control, and we got a surveillance state coming. And I remember at the time when 9/11 happened that, oh, we're in a post 9/11 world. And after that wears thin, and everybody knows, yeah, we've been lied to. Then it's a, oh, we're in a COVID 1984 world, And I. It seems that there's a commonality between the, certainly from my perspective, doing news. I mean, we have 50, 70 headlines a day on Freedom's Phoenix. I interview thousands and thousands and thousands of people since 03. I mean, this has been, I think I get it. To explain it to people, it's really took the last year and a half to see, yeah, they want the control and track everything that you're doing. And like you say, they have to have enemies. And in my experience, they needed three. I mean, it was like, you know, Iraq, Osama bin Forgotten, and North Korea or Iran or something. And whenever whenever you one drops off, you got to bring up another one. You got to have at least a backup or two backups. You know, three is one, you know, in their mind. Yeah. And I'm wondering who it is. Well, of course, now they're playing with the big boys, China and Russia. So the 9/11 thing, do you think it gave certainly families has the nationalism or the U.S. government or that's why this show is called Declare Your Independence, because role of government is defend individual rights. It's, you know, if they don't do that, it's your right, your duty to alter or abolish. I mean, it's, you know, it's so I can see them experiencing this and what they thought. And of course, the patriotic and revenge, you know, avenge, you know, my husband, my wife, my son, my daughter, my dad. Has it turned into an awareness that there is something else going on, that this is a long-term thing? Has there been some kind of conversion by you, you know, the people that you're giving a voice to, that there's something else going on? Has the petals fallen off the rose? I mean, you know, what do you think?
Yeah. So thankfully, in relation to what you're talking about, the Family Steering Committee did have a question about the project for the new American century. And yeah, I was interested to see that was there, because I've had to write within what I'll call the canon of their questions. And if there are questions that they didn't ask and other people have, I couldn't deal with it in my book, or, you know, I only got to deal with 12 questions because I could write a whole series about this. But Beverly Eckert.
Okay, wait. So you focused on the family's questions. You dealt with that.
With the questions that they actually asked the 9/11 Commission to investigate.
Got
and
it.
Even within, which might be a somewhat more contained framework of questions, because there's other questions you're asking and other people are asking, which are also good questions that have been asked generally in the 9/11 Truth Movement. But I'm asking the actual questions. Let's look at the actual questions that they asked the 9/11 Commission to investigate to get the government to have accountability and truth about this thing. And one of the
let's go ahead and preface this a little bit. So the 9/11 Commission the report was supposed to address these questions.
Yes, and they only answered 9% of those questions. Hundreds and hundreds of questions. They answered 9% of the questions. 70% they didn't answer at all. And I'll give you an example of the gray area where maybe the question was asked, we could say. Donald Rumsfeld was asked by one of the commissioners, Mr. Rumsfeld, did you order fighter jets to be scrambled to defend the Pentagon? And he thought about the question, I think, maybe thought about it, looked around, looked at the wall, looked at the clock, and slowly said, did I scramble fighter jets to defend the Pentagon? And then Chairman Tom Keene banged the gavel and said, time's up, next question.
Okay, I got to make a couple of comments here. One, on September 10th, the day before, Rumsfeld was up there. Hey, we lost a couple trillion dollars laying around here. It was next to my heart. You know, we'll get to that. And then boom, you know, that went away. Then you had, you mentioned PNAC, the Project for a New American Century or whatever. Explain to people what that was, who was on that, what the document signified, who these people were. And the question, when the families asked about that, what were they referring to?
So the families, in their research, because they were researching all kinds of things to find out what would be the good questions to ask the 9/11 Commission to investigate. And they found out that there was something called the Project for the New American Century, which is a neoconservative think tank established in the late 1990s. And they were interested in, the need for what they said in their 2000 report, a new Pearl Harbor event to happen before the American public would be mobilized in supporting some of their agenda. Which was, you know, the report urged the United States needed to preserve American military preeminence by greatly increasing military spending. However, they were concerned that in a post Cold War era, this could not be speedily achieved absent of some catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor. And so for Beverly Eckert, whose husband Sean Rooney died, she was very concerned that the authors of the report included people in the White House, Vice President Dick Cheney, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz, Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security Affairs John Bolton, and others. And you know, it was about, you know, 8 or 9 key people in the Bush White House. And she felt in an interview with her in the press that the important that the authors of the report, quote, be called by the 9/11 Commission and asked to explain their line of thinking and expectations, given the suggestion that this would be, this meaning 9/11, would be a good thing.
They answer that question, did they?
No, they didn't. They didn't ask that question. Dick Cheney was finally interviewed after Condoleezza Rice did testify with the cameras rolling before the 9/11 Commission. Then President Bush and Vice President Cheney went to meet with the 9/11 commissioners behind closed doors in secret,
not under oath.
You know. Sitting beside each other, maybe if Bush, who is hapless sometimes in the way he speaks, says something he shouldn't start saying, then Cheney can you know, grab his hand or press his foot on top of Bush's foot to say stop or something. No transcripts, nothing was learned about whatever they said. They could have talked about pizza, you know. So, you know, no answers.
What do you come away from this experience of going through this? Why did you do it? You know, that's one thing, you know, being Canadian and coming across this issue in Western Canada. You're in Western Canada, right?
Yeah, I'm in Vancouver, you're north of Seattle. Yeah.
Okay, so how did this get on your radar screen? Why do you care?
Okay. So, I mean, it goes back to where I was on September 11th. I was in Joshua Tree National Park. Part of a retreat program with 60 American citizens from across the USA. No TVs, no radios. We're off the grid. I go for a walk in the desert on the morning of September 11th, just after sunrise, see the cactus, the jackrabbits, go back inside for meditation and then stretching in a big hall. And then in comes the leader of the program, who's just been on the phone with someone on the East Coast and has people, you know, gather and tells us that the towers have been hit and the Pentagon has been hit. They're all still standing at that point. But so there's one couple in the room that has a financial advisor who manages their stock portfolio, who works in the Twin Towers, and they were sobbing and worried that the guy did live, but at the time they were worried he might have died. And so I couldn't leave for, you know, I had to cancel my plane. Well, everything was canceled. No flights anywhere except if you were a Bin Laden family member. And so I eventually, you know, 5 days later, I got a bus across from Seattle up to Vancouver and 3-hour wait at the border. And you know, life moved on. I mean, the war in Afghanistan happened. There was anthrax attacks, the war on terror, you know, the Iraq war, you know, all of that was going on, like for everybody, kind of just, you see the headlines, you just sort of carry on with whatever you can do or write a letter to somebody to say, I don't think Iraq war is a good idea. But anyway, it happens. And so, you know, I see Condoleezza Rice being interviewed by the 9/11 Commission. But otherwise, I was not really aware of the 9/11 Commission at all. The news up here didn't cover that story. I mean, I remember in high school watching the Watergate. I'd come home from school each day and watch the Watergate proceedings. But I didn't see 9/11 proceedings happening on my TV screen. I didn't know there were any public hearings or any commission hardly at all. And when the commission report came out, I didn't know about it. I just happened to bump into a book in 2007 by Kristen Breitweiser, one of the Jersey girls whose husband Ron died in the South Tower, called Wake Up Call, The Political Education of a 9/11 Widow. And I thought, how is it possible that I could go 6 years, I follow the news fairly closely. I'm not like someone who sits and watches the TV commentators every night, but I catch it, and mostly I catch it by reading it and listening to the radio a bit. And I thought, this is amazing that these families who've been portrayed to me in the media as only wanting to say the names of their loved ones again at anniversaries, or I've read some obituaries. Here are a bunch of people that didn't just decide to tuck in and have a private life, but they went and knocked on the doors of Congress and forced a reluctant Bush administration to have an investigation. And why haven't I heard about this? So, and then I went and I watched the documentary 9/11 Press for Truth. I went to their website and looked at their hundreds of questions and their nearly 50 press releases. And I read some other books along the way. And I created a file of news clippings, a couple thousand, eventually reading Paul Thompson's Terror Line and some other books. But it was a very solitary thing. And I would once in a while talk with people about September 11th. Nobody ever seemed to talk to me about know that there were families, the Family Steering Committee. What's that? Who's Patty Casaza? Who's Mindy Kleinberg? Who's Lori Van Auken, Monica Gabrielle, Sally Regenhardt? They didn't know these people's names at all. And so around 2015, I thought, I think maybe somebody, initially I was writing, I think like, I need to let people in my own country in Canada know, hey, we had 26 Canadians die on September 11th. We lost 159 in combat in the Afghan war. And it's all apparently because of 9/11. And so we need to understand this. And but of course, my book has caught on more in America. And so I decided to write the book, and so interviewed some people who are family members and a number of first responders. And it's a very emotional journey to write about this, it's been an honor.
But why?
To write about
I mean, you were looking at your Amazon and you have a previous book, or writing effort that you've had writing the sacred, you're being a man of faith, a psalm-inspired path to appreciating and writing sacred poetry. And then all of a sudden, boom, 9/11?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you see it a calling in some way or a need, or it was a void that needed to be filled? What was your motivation?
Well, I would be having conversations occasionally with people about this, about living in a post 9/11 world. And I thought, we're all living in a post 9/11 world. We're told this all the time. And I thought it was important to understand it. I knew that there were a lot of books about, politics, books about current events in history that were, I would say, more left brain, hard hitting books. And I knew that a lot of the people that took the writing workshops that I was leading for the last two decades, who were taking poetry workshops or writing memoir, journal writing for health and wellness as they recover from injury and illness at a hospital or grief and loss support groups, as much as they were interested in what I was bringing up in a conversation over coffee, I knew that other books like David Ray Griffin or Kevin Ryan were too steep a learning curve, a kind of a way of reading. It was too, either too dense or too academic, or just, there wasn't enough, for people that were used to reading a different kind of book. So I thought the way in to write a book for the people that I know that I thought should be interested is to write it with a lot of narrative, because what I've been doing before with my earlier book is inviting people to write, narrative, write memoir, write your own stuff, put it out there. And I thought the story that connects from my former work in this one is the story of the families and how they got from the place of grieving to becoming some of the best examples of champions of grassroots democracy in many decades. And I thought that story, plus being able to layer the actual quotes from their testimony before the 9/11 Commission and in other interviews and talking with first responders and all of those kinds of quotes, like hearing the first responders talk about what they encountered when they went in to rescue people in the buildings, hearing people talk about their questions firsthand, was a way of layering the material throughout my book so that people that I wanted to be able to read a book about this topic generally could hang in there And I think I'm talking to a few people who've taken writing workshops from me who told me that they would never have read a book about this normally, but the families was their way in to accept, to try, and they, you know, really found a book
so
compelling.
It was casting a net over a different audience. You know, it was to make sure, you know, they could get entertained and informed, but from a different perspective that normally they wouldn't have.
Yeah, it's just finding, like, because so often, I mean, you know, I mean, just think about the different people in the family you grew up or extended family. You know, we all seem to have sometimes almost like different brains. We don't always get each other, you know, and the way that people think about things, they're sort of starting places in terms of how they become interested in the topic is not the same. And so, I mean, I have a sister-in-law who's going to be reading my book soon. She's really interested in the families. I mean, a lot of people, when you say the word family, suddenly they get, you know, they feel all heart, open-hearted and a bit warm and fuzzy and curious. And, oh, I'm going to read about families. Well, I've got a family. I'll read about their family. You know, that's kind of like where they don't know all of what they're going to see in my book, but that's their, you know, their starting place. But my sister-in-law believes that, you know, like she always thought, well, a plane hit the tower fell, end of story. It's only now, 20 years after, that she's reading my book that she's going to find out there's more to it than just that. So at least I've got one more person, my sister-in-law, who's starting to ask some new questions after 20 years of thinking there were no questions to ask.
You know, one thing, while I got you, I wanted to ask this. Were they compensated in any way? You know, there was billions raised by the Red Cross for the families and so on that they never saw anything, you know, or certainly, you know, for a while, it was always their name of something, take care of the kids. Were they ever compensated in any substantial way?
A very interesting question. The there was in September, October, a bill before Congress to compensate the airlines, United and American Airlines. I think $15 billion. I'm not sure what, but anyways, in the billions, I think, bailout package. And somebody in the discussion at Congress said, you know, hey, wait a minute. If we give this huge bailout package to the airlines and don't give anything to the families, it's going to be a political firestorm. So then up comes this victims compensation fund. And the families start getting, you know, letters from the government saying you need to come to this meeting in Washington, D.C. or New York or wherever they could get them to cluster or Connecticut and come and hear about the victims compensation fund. And one of the stipulations was you'll be able to receive, we're going to have a formula for you to figure out how many hundreds of thousands or more you're going to be able to be eligible for.
But you can't sue anybody, and you can't say anything, and you cannot
sue the American government.
Right.
Which is why they ended up having the 9/11 commission instead, which had very few subpoenas. Most people were never testifying under oath. And there were government minders who were often a witness in many of the, you know, there's the 12 public hearings of 18 days of public hearings, but there's also, you've got 8 or 9 teams on the 9/11 commission staff of nearly 80 staff who are meeting with other people behind closed doors. And it often as not, you have someone from the CIA or the FBI or the FAA or the DOD, and they're there as a witness. And they are testifying with a government minder, somebody who is a higher up in their department. That person standing behind them, perhaps with a hand on their shoulder, or sitting beside them. And sometimes a commissioner will, or a staff, a team member will ask the witness a question, and the government minder will answer it for them. These witnesses were self-censoring, and the families were alarmed about this because if you think that anything you're going to say in front of the commission staff and commissioners is going to get back to your department and there'll be retribution, you might not say what you think you could say. And often people didn't. And so this is, you know, a huge problem. So, yeah, so that's a lot of what happened there.
I won't keep you a whole lot longer, but I really like the perspective that you've done. This is something that we haven't really done before, is instead of, you know, we're, you know, I had to ask the molten metal thing because freaking you got to ask that question because that's really got me. I refused to talk about all the other crap until somebody would, you know, address that. And eventually we started getting answers. But the involvement of the families and the real victims at the time, it was a criminal investigation. It should be conducted as a criminal. Instead of they're doing an act of terrorism, it's an act of war. So we got to get some war. We need some war footing and PNAC war. And of course we went down that road and it still is devastating to our future and debt and everything. But we never got any real satisfaction for the real victims of this. And I'm wondering if they feel that they were made whole at all. Did they ever get any compensation? You know, I remember the Red Cross was collecting tons of money. Woo, they got some. Did it ever get dispersed?
Yeah, I understand that the Victims' Compensation Fund through Congress did give money to families. But the other story that goes side by side with the families more generally who lost loved ones on September 11th is the story of the first responders and those who went down to the pile to look for remains, find bodies, whatever they could, so that people could be identified and properly dealt with the remains of their bodies and burials. And those people, as John Stewart could tell you, have had a long and difficult struggle to get any compensation at all. You'd have senators and members of Congress talking about 9/11 heroes one day, and the next day saying, no, we can't give any of these people any health benefits to deal with their illnesses from asbestos and other stuff, you know, and many people, thousands of people have died who were involved in trying to do the cleanup. So it's a different kind of crime, this whole story.
Did the airlines and some of the other people, they got theirs? I bet they got there. They get theirs.
They got theirs, and so did the very fortunate purchaser of the World Trade Center, who already had World Trade Center Building 7, but Larry Silverstein bought World Trade Center 1, 2, 4, and 5, I think, just 6 weeks before the towers collapsed and the whole place went up. And he had the foresight somehow to get terrorist insurance and got $4.5 billion out of it. So he got well handsomely paid, you know. So there's lots of things there that in the ashes of this whole story.
Okay, I want to ask you this. Having done this, you know, certainly when Silverstein did, we just pulled it, you know, Building 7, we're just going to bring it down. Or you got the BBC up there saying Building 7, you know, collapsed and it's sitting over their shoulder. I mean, you know, all this stuff is just from investigation from people looking at footage, talking about it, putting it together. You know, we used to do during the Levolution years 7 and 8, we would do 9/11 compilations on DVDs. We had a 3 11 stack duplicators. We'd make 300 to 500 DVDs an hour, and we would put hundreds of thousands of them out. We were real buttheads about it. Yeah. So I've seen all of that, and I'm just, you look at that and you go, what are we up against? There's something else that runs everything, and I'm wondering if these families realize that they're going, this is not a buy for of thing. We are our loved ones were sacrificed, and the rescue workers, you know, I'm glad you brought that up. You know, that was what really got Luke Radowski, you know, all involved because of the damage that was done in France. And I'm wondering, there has to be any pushback. Is there any revelation? Are they still voting? They're going to vote harder next time? I mean, what do you see the solution? Because it's going to happen again. It has happened again. This last year and a half, it has happened again, and it will keep happening. What's the solution? I mean, you know, Ray, you got to help me out, man. This is great stuff, but there has to be some revelation that we have to it stop.
Well, I think that the only thing that we can all hope to do, what you're doing on your show all the time, and what I've done now in writing the book I've written, and what other people I've spoken with on interviews recently. I was talking with Joe Krakenfels, whose nephew Leonard Snyder died. Bob McElvain, whose son Bobby Jr. died. That is that there are still many people. I mean, Dylan Avery's new film, The Unspeakable. There's still many people who are hoping that they'll be the 100th monkey, that somehow what they do might be a breakthrough of some sort. None of us knows anything that we do, any interview in particular, any book we write, any film that comes out, any protest, any meeting with a member of Congress or whatever. None of us knows which one of us is going to do something where there's suddenly going to be a breakthrough. But we all do what we need to do and that we think that we imagine that we can do so that something can catch hold of a wider imagination, that people start to revisit this whole story. And I think that people for 20 years have been told it's a conspiracy theory, and yet the official story is a conspiracy theory itself, because two or more people were gathered together to do something nefarious, according to the official account. Nobody in Washington, D.C. says this happened because one person acted alone. So we need to snap out of, you know, the name calling and get to, you know, down to ask the, you know, the revisit the family's questions again and take them seriously and, you know, switch up our thinking, because this otherwise we're in for a really dire direction.
You know, I think they're ready to pull the trigger on a control grid, control of they got the tech now, we're going to use the control. And 9/11 was a big part of this. And I think it's unique that you had the opportunity and the foresight to go after what hadn't been done before, which is the family story. And I want to thank you for that. And I'm glad that we have this opportunity to get inside their minds. How much do you get into their individual? How many of the families, how many people are we talking about that you interviewed or you're representing? You know, it was just those questions. You talked to a lot of the people, the activists. A lot of people didn't want to be talked to. Leave me alone. I'm going to vote harder next time or something. I mean, was there a common philosophy that came out of this from everybody that you could feel? I mean, what do you think?
I mean, I've talked or been in touch with by email with you know, a little over a dozen people. I have watched lots of footage of testimony and read people's statements and sifted through a lot of material. So, you know, there's you know, dozens and dozens. I mean, I've read all the 503 first responders' testimony about their experience in the World Trade Center and many family statements. And there are families today, I'd say, well, you know, over half the families affected by this have chosen to accept the official story. And you can probably see some of them being interviewed on CNN and other places where, you know, these people that, I mean, Deborah Burlingame, whose brother was flying the plane that flew into the Pentagon, will tell you, you know, she was involved in a family group with Liz Cheney, the daughter of the vice president. So it's, you know, there are people who are strongly on side with the official account. And then there are many others who are dissenting still. You know, talking to some of these folks just recently, just the other day, I mean, you know, Joe Krakenfels down in Florida says, you know, he says the whole war on terror is phony. And so, you know, they're boiling mad after 20 years. And so, you know, I think that there's a lot of people have a real fire in their belly and they're not going to stop asking questions. It doesn't matter whether the big mainstream media, you know, carries their, you know, interviews them or talks to them. They're just carrying on quietly, you know, like under the ground. It's like the roots that you don't see in the tree over there. They're still doing things. And the conversations are still happening.
How do you think this is going to manifest a solution in the future? We'll leave on that. I want to give you opportunity to promote your book and where they can get it. And when's it? It just, the ebook just came out, right?
Yeah, the ebook just came out on on Saturday. I mean, the book was officially, published, released on Saturday, a few pre-orders before that. So, I mean, I think that, the whole story of September 11th, is a story which is full of huge problems, the official account. And as Paul Thompson has said, we can't base our whole life, change our whole way of thinking, have mass surveillance, endless permanent wars, on a false understanding of September 11th. So I think that the boulder that we have to push, and I think it is a bit of a boulder, is to try and get other people to join us and move and roll the stone away so that people can have a much better understanding of what's going on, and then to be smart to ask some more questions like the ones you're asking about what's going on now.
Yeah, I hope this it's 20 years. I think the COVID overshadowed a lot of the what might have been more asking of questions, but of course we've promoted that we're glad to have you on, to bring this back up when it needed to be. And it's been a ride for a lot of us that, 20 years ago, I was 40. This has been my adult life, raising my kids and grandkids in the middle of this, being an activist, having gone through many of these kinds of things, economic turmoil, false flag economic crap, false flag war crap. I mean, it's just been a continuous cycle. And when you mentioned PNAC, the Project for a New American Century, that they needed something like this to galvanize support for, we got to go spend a bunch more, military money. And then we leave it in Afghanistan. Here, you guys can have it. It's just been such a joke. And it's not funny anymore. I mean, at some point it was just, absurd, and you had to just, smile at each other and go, man, are they stupid? But they're dangerous stupid. And they're dangerous. They're preteens with car keys and whiskey and pickup trucks. I mean, it's dangerous what's happening. And I don't know what the next phase of this is going to be, other than we're going to get more of the same until we have an understanding of what got us here and the truth behind it. And that's the slogan for Freedom's Phoenix: uncovering the secrets, exposing the lies. There's a lot of secrets and a lot of lies that need to be exposed. And I'm wanting to make sure that your book gets a chance, because it comes at it from a different perspective that I don't think we've seen really before. So I'm glad that you did it. I think it's something that needs to be on somebody's shelf to have reference for those that wouldn't be exposed or allow themselves to be exposed to this mind trauma in any other way. And I think that was a good idea that you did. I'm glad you did it. Ray McGinnis, go ahead and give out your webpage real quick before we go, so they know where to go and find you. Your webpage.
Oh, yes. www.unanswered.ca.
Or Canuckin.
Yes.
Unanswered.ca. And if you go to today's archive, you'll see all the connections there, and you can get his book. And, I just to have it. If you, of course, I encourage you to read it, but, just to have it up there for that one person in your family that would not be exposed to this kind of information any other way, but through a family's perspective. And I know you're saying there's other family members that I'm sure, with the narrative that the government puts out, and I'd be interested in a book written on why. I mean, then you start looking at conflicts of interest.
That's chapter 20 in my book.
There you go. Good. Thank you for doing that. Ray McGinnis, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for coming on. This is a pleasant conversation on a terrible subject that I'm glad we got to put some light on. Is there anything else you wanted to share with the audience?
Oh, I think just really great to be here. And I think that, for people listening, if they think, is there someone that they know that's been cautious or sitting on the fence somehow for two decades and hasn't wanted to really think about this topic or hasn't thought that they needed to think about this topic, that my book might be, you know, a doorway for that person that you know that just might be willing, who maybe doesn't like politics or doesn't want to get into, you know, conflict or whatever. But this is a book that could be a book for them to start reading with interest and compassion about the families and then follow their journey as they went to Washington.
You got a long journey ahead of, I mean, you can't be not affected for the rest of your life with something like this. It's just, and I'm glad you give, you know, the people that wanted to have a voice, an additional voice. Ray McGinnis, thank you very much. The book is Unanswered Questions, What the September 11th Families Asked and the 9/11 Commission Ignored. Thank you, Ray.
Thanks so much, Ernie. Bye-bye.
Peace.